Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A petition is filed to remove Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden from office. The sheriff says the allegations being made are lies.
The petition is nothing but a smear campaign.
Meanwhile, a comment from last summer.
All cultures are not equal.
Brings this response.
That is not something I can endorse.
As Governor Stein throws his support to Carla Cunningham's challenger in the race for the General Assembly. Charlotte leaders are invited to testify in Raleigh about alleged failures in the area of public safety. An audit looks at the dwindling amount of money from the education lottery making its way to education. Plus, tomorrow, the Panthers search for a victory in their first playoff game since 2018. And here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE political reporter Steve Harrison. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. They're all with us. Good morning. Welcome back from the holidays.
Morning.
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 We're not going to begin there, though. We're going to begin with something else, completely different that I had not anticipated talking about at all until late last night. Since Wednesday, the nation has been coming to terms with the fatal shooting by an ICE agent in Minneapolis of a woman in a car on a neighborhood street. And then last night, there was another shooting involving federal agents who were trying to make a vehicle stop in Portland, Oregon. An officer or officers were allegedly hurt in that incident, and two people in the car were shot. They fled the scene and took themselves to a hospital where they were apprehended, as best we know. The Minneapolis incident resulted in demonstrations in cities around the country. Charlotte was one of those cities where a protest took place last night.
Justice for Renee Nicole Good.
Justice for Renee Nicole Good.
Justice for Renee Nicole Good.
Protesters in Charlotte chanting the name of the woman who died in Minnesota, Renee Nicole Good. WFAE's Julian Berger was at the rally. He joins us now. And Ryan Pitkin from Queen City Nerve was also there. He'll join in this conversation as well. So, Julian, where did this protest take place and how did it come together?
Yes, this protest, it was at First Ward Park in Uptown Charlotte, and it was organized by PSL Charlotte, the Party for Socialism and Liberation. They're the ones that typically hold all of the CBP ICE-related protests in the city.
Did it come together organically? Did they have a network that they correspond with that brings people together in times like this?
Yeah, so typically they'll post a flyer on social media and kind of spread the word through online. They also have partner organizations like Carolina Migrant Network, which they focus on providing legal services to immigrants. They'll also help spread the word as well.
So, Ryan, how many people were there participating in this protest last night and how long did it go on?
I would say about 300, maybe. It was definitely a few hundred. I'm bad at the crowd guesses as long as I've been covering protests for 20 years, but that's about my guess. And it was a couple hours. I actually paid 2 hours for a 2-hour parking spot, and I filled it exactly. So they started at First Ward Park with a few speeches from organizers, folks with Action NC, Carolina Migrant Network, things like that. They marched around Uptown, up 7th Street, down North Tryon, down Tryon to 3rd Street, back to First Ward Park. Very incident-free. There was no sort of aggression or anything. Police were riding from the back and sides of them and sort of cutting off traffic where they were marching. And then they got back and gave us a few more speeches.
Julian, we heard the chant a moment ago that protesters engaged in, among other things. They also carried signs with various different messages. What did the sign say? What was the ultimate goal of this protest?
Yeah, I think the ultimate goal was to call out, to kind of bring justice and accountability to what happened in Minneapolis, but also to kind of call out the actions that ICE and CBP have been taking in the past recent months. I think for the people that were protesting here in Charlotte, it was kind of personal because people saw with their own eyes kind of what CBP was doing in our city, especially to U.S. citizens who were out on our streets.
Federal officials are calling the shooting in Minneapolis justified. That is before any investigation has occurred. The president and the vice president and the head of Homeland Security have all come to a conclusion that she was wrong, they were right. And what they're saying happened is not what we're necessarily seeing in the videos that have been recorded by camera phones on the scene. You spoke with Asha Patel, Julian, who helped organize this protest in Charlotte last night. She says citizens are concerned by what they see as a broader pattern of behavior by these federal agents.
We are seeing through this that this current administration and ICE will unleash violence on anyone who takes a stand against this deportation machine and this crackdown.
Did you hear anyone else express similar sentiments?
Yes, all the speakers that were there last night expressed similar sentiments. One notable speaker, Marianne Ruiz from the Carolina Migrant Network, she read all of the names of people that have been killed by ICE, whether they were in ICE detention, ICE custody, things like that. And they were over 30, 40 names that she had read. A very powerful moment in the protest that I thought.
10, as I understand it, 10 people have been shot by ICE or Border Patrol in the last several months. So this is getting pretty serious. Charlotte just went through, as you alluded to, their own experience with Border Patrol in November. And, of course, ICE has been here for quite a while. Activity in November resulted in some serious disruptions to commerce and to people's lives in the immigrant community, not to mention trauma. How has that incident in Minneapolis affected those folks, Julian?
Yeah, I think it's kind of put us in a moment, especially for the immigrant community, where they're kind of questioning what's next, what else is ICE going to do in the future, how stronger is ICE going to become as an agency in their tactics.
Ryan?
I thought from a local aspect, it was interesting and important to mention that Hector Vaca with ActionNC made a point during his speech at the beginning to note that CMPD, he thanked CMPD partnering with CBP when they were here during their specific operation in November, but said that his organization's goal in the coming months will be preparing for the next arrival of CBP by trying to convince CMPD officials to take a more firm stance against them rather than just be completely neutral, to actually, I don't know in what ways to act against them, but to take a more firm stance in protecting the immigrant community here in Charlotte.
And many people are concerned with justification about how ICE agents and Border Patrol agents are executing their mission in terms of the aggression that they are using. And yesterday, the shooting of that woman on Wednesday, in Minneapolis is a good example of why we should all be concerned about this. Julian Berger from WFAE News, thanks for being with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Steve, State Democratic Representative Carla Cunningham was in the news twice this week. We're going to start with her decision, along with four others, to file a petition to remove Democratic Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden from office. What are they alleging in this petition?
Yeah, they are using what I would say is a little-known piece of state law that allows for the removal of a sheriff or a law enforcement officer based on a petition of five residents within that county. And they, Carla Cunningham is one, McFadden's former chief deputy, Kevin Canty, is another. And they are alleging, a whole kind of laundry list of complaints and allegations. The law doesn't require that there be criminal behavior. I mean, it allows for removal for willful or habitual neglect or refusal to perform duties of office, willful misconduct or maladministration. And so they are alleging that the sheriff retaliates against whistleblowers, against his employees, mismanages the jail. A lot of these things have come out in the media and in past stories before. The sheriff, as we heard at the top of the show, is calling them lies and a smear and denying the charges.
And when WCNC-TV spoke with Gary McFadden, he characterized, as you just said, these allegations as lies.
The petition is nothing but a smear campaign designed just before the election.
So, Ben, the allegations may or may not be true, but talk about the timing. The primary election is quickly approaching. Is there something to be said about the timing of this?
I think there is. I mean, I think the first thing is the day after these allegations came forward, we had an interview planned with the sheriff, and he kept that interview, and we talked to him, and he couldn't say much at that point. He said a little bit later that day on Tuesday, and he points out that, you know, we're about 2 months away from the primary season. He faces, I think, at least three challengers in the primary. So he's saying this is purely political. But I mean, people who've been following the sheriff knows he's been controversial. A lot of these things are not totally new. The allegations are not totally new involved in this, although the method, this petition, as Steve alluded to, were new. The sheriff says this is, you know, retaliation. This is political. A lot of folks will say these things have been brewing for quite some time. They didn't come up just 2 months before a primary.
Yeah, the allegations that have come out over a long period of time, several years, have involved his approach to running the office, bullying tactics, etc., or allegations of those things. But these allegations include using the sheriff's office credit cards for hotel upgrades, making deputies drive, visiting officials to strip clubs, possible violations of the Hatch Act, which prohibits the using government facilities, properties, or personnel for political purposes. But the most serious charge, Alex, is that being levied by Carla Cunningham, who is saying that the sheriff threatened her. When did he allegedly do that, and why?
Yeah, this happened allegedly last year around the time when Cunningham overrode the veto on the immigration bill that was really controversial, that required the sheriff to cooperate more with ICE. And apparently, according to the petition, there was a phone call that happened where McFadden said to Cunningham that if she voted with Republicans, people would come after her. And there's a quote in there that says, "I don't want to see you get hurt. You live in my county." Cunningham took this as a threat. She compared it to a mafia boss. And she, the petition says that this is extortion.
The ability to make this move, people have talked about removing him before, but we were always told you couldn't do it. Well, clearly you can. This little known law allows five people to file a petition, and then it's supposed to go to the district attorney, who decides whether or not to submit that information to a superior court judge. Mecklenburg County District Attorney Spencer Merriweather was on this program earlier this week, and he told us he asked the State Bureau of Investigation now to look into this.
I have to make a decision as to whether that's something that would move forward. A person in that position can't make that kind of decision without some level of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why typically the district attorney or county attorney would ask for an investigative agency to look at.
And McFadden says he welcomes the investigation into the allegations put forth in this petition.
It is filled with lies, and we welcome the investigation. And we respect the investigation that will be occurring. And that is all we're going to say at this time.
Sheriff McFadden on WCNC-TV. Ryan, Queen City Nerve published an in-depth story going back to 2022 about former employees who had been speaking out against the sheriff. What were they saying then? And how does it compare to the allegations in this petition?
Oh, yeah. That reporting I did in 2022 is right up top of the petition, not the reporting itself, I mean, but those allegations of making an unsafe environment in the jail by not only understaffing, but also by putting inmates over staff, basically building loyalty with certain inmates and their families, which they say was a good thing when he was a homicide detective, but say is unsafe as a sheriff running a jail, basically.
A little more to talk about with regard to this petition being filed to remove Gary McFadden from office. We'll get into that in a moment. Then we'll talk about Charlotte Leaders being summoned to Raleigh to talk about public safety and the Mint Hill terror plot that was recently foiled, all on the local news roundup.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcltregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. Therefore, Steve Harrison is with us. He's our political reporter at WFAE News. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nervous. And Alexandria Sands is with us. She's a reporter for Axios Charlotte. We've been talking about these the petition being filed to remove Sheriff Gary McFadden from Mecklenburg County from office, allegations of bullying and disrespecting members of his department, verbal abuse, and more have surfaced over years, many years. And McFadden has always denied them. He even felt it, said it, at one time he felt betrayed by those making those false accusations, betrayed by his staff members. He did come into that job after years, Ryan, in law enforcement, and you just mentioned that he had been, a police detective for many, many years, and he has made aggressive moves to reshape the organization, and some have chalked these complaints that have come down the pike over the years as simply people being resistant to change. Is this investigation by the State Bureau of Investigation that has been launched now likely to be able to determine what the real story is here?
Well, it's funny thing is that a lot of the tension or a lot of the allegations thrown at him are not really connected to the more public battles that he has with ICE, for example. He came in and ended the 287G policy in the Mecklenburg Sheriff's Office, which was their sort of way of complying with ICE rules and partnering with that agency. And he ended that right off the bat. But a lot of the allegations here in this petition are not related to any of that. That's the stuff that sort of gets headlines here and there, like once a year. But these are all sort of more related to problems that his staff has had over the years. And they've been saying this over and over. And now they have an NC lawmaker that's sort of heading up a petition and telling them about this little known rule that they can use. So it's sort of some of the more behind the scenes issues that he's seen that are, you know, now coming to light in a major way.
And the sheriff explained his point of view on all this way to WCNC-TV.
Well, we're always concerned about how someone tried to create a different image of you. We're always going to be concerned about that. People who know me know my image, they know my style. And so, you know, it is always that era that we have when it becomes election season. And so we're in the middle of election season, 60 days out from the primary. So we all understand that. It is devastating to my staff, my family, and also to myself. But we have to leave it to the process.
So McFadden is up for re-election. And even before these allegations came to light, he faced three Democratic challengers in the March 3rd primary. No Republican at the moment has announced an intention to run here. Among his challengers are two former employees of the Sheriff's Department. Have either Rodney Collins or Antoine Nance lodged any complaints against McFadden in the past, Ben?
I'm not specifically sure about them. I know the former employees at the Sheriff's Department, as we've alluded to, are part of the complaints that have been filed. And before that, there have been others before them. The two deputies and then the person within the sheriff's, within the city police department, I'm not specifically sure. But as we alluded to, there have been several in the past who have.
Alex, is this investigation likely to be concluded prior to the primary on March 3rd or even prior to the general election in November?
I think that's hard to say. There's just no set timeline, but I haven't heard anything about, you know, getting on this super quickly. So I feel like March is coming up fast. I don't know if it'll be done by then. I think that at this point, it's more just going to bring a lot of attention to that race than we've ever seen before.
He's high profile, Steve. Politically speaking, is there any way to gauge what kind of impact this petition or these accusations may have on the outcome of the primary election for the moment?
Yeah, I think it's a big deal. I think this story will be in the news for several cycles. It will be something that people think about. But remember, you know, the sheriff went through a lot of these same allegations. I mean, no petition, but these same allegations of mismanagement and bullying 4 years ago when he had credible challengers in the primary then and won. And he does have a lot of goodwill in the community. in terms of his resistance to work with ICE, in terms of his beliefs about rehabilitation in the jail. There's a lot of goodwill there. And for the district attorney, this is going to be an incredibly hard decision. In his letter explaining, you know, laying out the process of what was happening next, he appeared very conflicted, saying, look, the ultimate way, the best way to remove a public official is through the ballot box. And, you know, but he said, look, under state law, that either I have to review this or the Mecklenburg County attorney, I will do it. So I think Spencer Merriweather is going to face a really very difficult decision, probably after the primary. It seems like it would be tough to get this done by March, whether to present this case to a Superior Court judge.
Brian.
I mentioned in one of our newsletters this week, this is like an unstoppable force of controversy meeting an immovable object of controversy, with Carla Cunningham and McFadden sort of going head to head, because these are two very strong incumbents who have faced controversy, maybe not as much as recently for Cunningham, but they are two people who seem to get voted in regardless of what happens to them, sort of bulletproof. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in 2026.
And we're going to talk about the other controversy surrounding Carla Cunningham a little bit later on in the program. As was reported extensively over the holidays, the FBI thwarted a possible terrorist attack in Mint Hill on New Year's Eve. It was allegedly a plot in which an 18-year-old, Christian Sturdivant, from Mint Hill, was planning some attacks. And this week, the court denied bond in his case, so he will remain in jail awaiting trial. Remind us, Ben, what he was allegedly planning to do.
The prosecutors maintain that this guy, this 18-year-old, was describing himself as a soldier of ISIS, that he was getting ready. He was getting his stuff together for an attack on New Year's. And it would be at the Burger King he worked, and it was at a Harris Teeter in Publix, a Publix where I think his grandfather worked. And he was expecting to die in this whole thing, in the attack, and die and become a martyr. And prosecutors understandably take that sort of stuff very seriously. They say he reached out to a social media account he believed was ISIS. It was, in fact, I think, an NYPD account that they had put out. They're the ones who got in touch with prosecutors. That is the one side of it, which is very serious. The other side, his attorney, arguing this was a whole online thing that he had created that appeared to be serious, but that it was not anything actionable, that he literally did not have the resources or money to carry something like this out. He didn't have any payment apps. He didn't have any of the more serious weapons. And that this was a lot of talk and a lot of bluster, but not a lot of action.
And I asked Russ Ferguson, the U.S. attorney, about that, because some critics say that when the FBI does these things, they are entrapping these individuals who don't have the wherewithal to pull things off and giving them that, or making them think they have it, and then they get them in trouble. But he said they were very careful about not acting in that way in this case. He's been on the FBI's radar since he was 14 years old, when he was going around his neighborhood carrying knives and hammers and threatening to attack his neighbors, allegedly. And according to Russ Ferguson, he was on this program on Tuesday. He resurfaced just before Christmas.
He got in touch with an NYPD undercover that he thought was ISIS, and started talking about his plans for jihad on New Year's Eve. And obviously we surged resources to that to protect the public.
And Ferguson described the plan as very well thought out. According to the FBI, he pledged, as you said, his allegiance to ISIS. He allegedly had written a manifesto outlining the attack. Again, Russ Ferguson.
I mean, he had been indoctrinated online by ISIS, and all you can do is exactly what law enforcement did here, have undercovers ready and try to find these people in the planning stages before they do it.
And WCNC reports, Ben, that James Barnicle, a special agent with the FBI, says they are leaving no stone unturned in this investigation, which is ongoing. What else are they looking for?
I think some of the reasoning behind it, I mean, because Sturdivant had indicated that from a young age, ISIS gave him a sense of belonging. So what happens to have a 18-year-old in Mint Hill, North Carolina, all of a sudden need or want to associate it with it? Because I know he lives with his grandparents. His grandparents had indicated they had put him inside in a mental health care facility to help address some of these things. It seemed like they were trying to do the right thing. So what happens when you have, guardians, grandparents trying to help a kid out, and it still ends up like this, even though they knew there was trouble from a very early age?
So switching our attention back to Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden for a moment, the North Carolina House Oversight Committee has requested he and other local officials come to Raleigh and testify about their role in public safety in Charlotte. They've invited the mayor, the district attorney, Spencer Merriweather, city manager Marcus Jones, CATS interim CEO Brett Cagle, and Mecklenburg County manager Mike Bryant. Is appearance at this festivity, Alex, optional, or have they been subpoenaed?
Correct me if I'm wrong, guys. I believe it sounds optional, but the sheriff has said that he already said he's going. I'm not sure about the other officials, but I think it's a pretty bad look also if you don't show up there. The sheriff said, I have nothing to hide. It kind of looks like you don't want to be held accountable for your actions if you don't come.
And of course, CATS is involved in this invitation because it's about safety on the light rail, where two stabbings have occurred in the last 6 months. But the committee also wants to ask questions about DEI initiatives, strategic plans, and spending. Have they been any more specific than that, Ben?
Not really. I think if you've been covering this stuff for a while, you saw this coming months ago after Irina Zaruzza was killed on the light rail. And then there was another stabbing on the light rail just about 2 months ago. So I think this has been a long time coming. And I think if it stopped at just public safety, everybody would be like, yeah, you know what? It makes sense. There's been a problem people are worried about. It's the comma that comes after that in the sentence that is DEI initiatives. Strategic plans, strategic plans could be anything, and spending. So I have a feeling, just like you watch some of these hearings that happen in D.C. and they become a big thing, I have a feeling you could watch this and this could end up being a far encompassing hearing that touches on just about every issue that Raleigh and Charlotte do not agree on right now, which is a lot.
Everything. Queen City News reports that Representative Brendan Jones, one of the three co-chairs of this committee, Republican, says, quote, due to the gross mismanagement within the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Department, not to mention its blatant disregard for state law, the committee has invited Sheriff Gary McFadden to testify on his department's failures. Now, the sheriff, as you mentioned, Ben, says he's looking forward to testifying and plans to fully cooperate, saying, quote, he has nothing to hide because unlike municipal police departments and most other sheriff's offices across the state, his office does not answer calls for service. They operate the jail. They handle the courthouse security and detention-related duties. Why, if they're interested in public safety, Alex, was nobody from CMPD invited to participate, or were they?
I believe Estella Patterson, the new CMPD chief, was invited. I think... I don't know how much she'll have to say. She just started the job in December. I think that the sheriff was more like the star of the show here to bring the attention to because of mostly ICE issues and also Border Patrol. He was frequently referred to when Republicans were saying, if you guys don't like Border Patrol in Charlotte, well, then the sheriff should have honored our detainers and should have cooperated more. So he's kind of taken on that role for Republicans to target the Charlotte's Democratic leadership.
And in that letter that the committee chairs sent to the sheriff, it tells him to be prepared to, quote, discuss your office's role in ensuring public safety throughout the city of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, including CATS. From what the sheriff has said, he doesn't have a role in much of that, does he?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. I think it's kind of to Ben's point, it's going to cover so many things. So it will be good also that Brent Cagle is there to talk about CATS. Because I think another big issue out of this is that the state auditor, who is also a Republican, investigated CATS earlier in 2024 or 2025. And one of the issues that he found was that he thought Charlotte was using a DEI process to hire their security, and that shouldn't have been something that factored into making decisions about public safety because the city of Charlotte was specifically looking at minority women and small businesses. And he said that might have limited. People were excluded, other qualified vendors who potentially could have been better. But he didn't say, he didn't say there's anything wrong with the way that CAT security was actually operating right now. Mostly the audit was concerned with the number of guards.
If you read the letter that they sent to the sheriff, and I'm sure they sent similar letters to other people being used by these committee chairs, it all sounds somewhat political. Steve, is this just about a Republican legislature taking a tough stance on a blue city, another skirmish in the war between left and right?
I think it's partly that, but I do think there are some real concerns on the right about how Gary McFadden and other sheriffs and, you know, work with ICE. I think they feel like that's a legitimate issue. And then, you know, the killing on the light rail was a very big deal, not just to Republicans, but to everyone. And so I do think there'll be a bit of a carnival atmosphere about this, but I do think that the GOP feels like they are bringing up important issues for the city and the state.
So this comes, this invitation to testify comes the same week that the Charlotte Safety Council held its first meeting. This is actually a revival of a committee that had been ended or wrapped into another committee. Why are they bringing it back as a separate entity, Ben?
Well, when I did my end of year interview with the mayor a few weeks ago, I asked her, what is the number one priority this city faces headed into 2026? And she immediately gave me the answer, public safety. I think this is part of that. Other council members I've spoken to said basically the same exact thing. And I think this, you can't disconnect this conversation to the conversation we just had. And I think, you know, the mayor can go into that hearing in Raleigh we just talked about, but not only that, but also go in front of constituents and say, hey, this is just one example. This is one offering that we're showing to say that we are taking public safety important. We are devoting a committee. It was tied in with housing and community there for a long time. Now it's going to be its own separate thing. Dante Anderson is leading it. She's chairing it. And this is their way of saying, hey, we are taking this seriously. Raleigh, anybody else who wants to criticize us, and trying to make this a bigger priority for the people of Charlotte.
So this committee will focus on the intersection of mental health, substance abuse, and public safety. City Council's Dante Anderson is that committee's chair.
We fully understand as a committee and as a council that public safety doesn't necessarily equate to law enforcement solely.
So at this first meeting, some committee members expressed concern about data showing the prevalence of mental health issues among those entering the justice system, and both IRENA's law, which went into effect on December the 1st, and this committee were a response to the brutal stabbing of Irina Zarudzka. One of the criticisms of that law is that it focuses on prosecution and provides additional resources, but very few, if any, for mental health treatment. When we come back, I want to ask you, Ben, since this committee acknowledges the need for that, what can they do about it? We'll take a break. We'll come back in a moment in Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. Steve Harrison is with us, our political reporter at WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerves. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Ben Thompson is with us. He's an anchor at WCNC-TV. At this first meeting of the Public Safety Committee, they acknowledged the need for more mental health treatment, and they were worried about the number of people entering the criminal justice system who need that help. IRENA's law wants public safety but doesn't provide any resources in that area. So since this committee has acknowledged the need, what can they do about it, Ben?
Well, you touched on it just right there in your question, and that's an issue of resources. Going back to that crime, but just in general, historically, contextually, there's a different approach when it comes to crime, often between the left and the right. And the left often talks about mental health resources, where you could say the right is more interested in saying, oh, lock them up and you know, in crime and punishment. You have, I think, a city council that genuinely believes that you can't approach crime without addressing mental health resources. So I would guarantee that it will come up in the conversations that are happening in a few weeks between Charlotte and Raleigh, when leaders are going to testify, that resources are going to be brought up as an issue of, we can only do so much with the resources you have given us. I mean, that's been the biggest criticism of ARENA's law is okay, well, that's great, but we need more resources to carry out some of these things, whether it's more judges or more prosecutors, or yes, more mental health resources as well.
In this first meeting this week of this new committee, this public safety committee, a lot of things came up, not just ARENA's law and mental health issues, but concern over how recent violent episodes affect the city's reputation, to concerns over a lack of resources in every area to address the problem. Councilwoman Dimple Ishmara.
It's really a financial problem. We need more funding for the DA's office. We need more funding for our judicial mm-hmm. system. We need more funding for our mental health support. Mm-hmm. And all of that comes from the state.
So if that comes up at these meetings that these city council, that these city leaders have been summoned to in Raleigh, how will it be taken? Because we seem to be throwing the problem back at them.
Oh, I mean, they're going to get pushback, of course. I don't think Raleigh's going to take that line down and be like, okay, here's a few more million dollars. Hopefully, you know, I do think the transit plan is an example of where I feel like the mayor and some city leaders have enjoyed a slightly better, more positive, more productive relationship with folks in Raleigh. So I would imagine that the conversations between them are going to be on the healthier side and try to be more productive. Because when it comes to a lot of these things, when push comes to shove, Raleigh ends up having, you know, a final say.
Alex, you recently reported that the North Carolina Education Lottery, which was launched in 2005, 20 years ago, to provide a boost for school funding, is earmarking a smaller and smaller share each year to education. How long has this been going on?
Well, there was a new audit that came out from the state auditor's office that looked at just the past 3 years, and it saw that they saw that the money going to education dropped, went from 23% in 2023 to 20% in 2024, and then 16% in 2025. But what's concerning here is that 2025 was actually a record year for sales, but schools got $20 million less dollars.
And when they passed this law, I believe we were promised that 35% of the money would go to education. 16% is a far cry from 35%. That's basic arithmetic. It was a slog to get this lottery passed, and it passed in large part because of that promise that money would be furnished to education. Despite warnings from other states that had already had education lotteries in place, that it didn't always work out that way. This was uncovered through an audit by the Office of the State Auditor. Did their findings believe this to be intentional, or is this some sort of a system problem?
There's actually just this strange thing happening. It's kind of a coincidence, I guess. There just weren't enough Powerball or Mega Million sales in 2025 because there were like only two big winners. And I guess when you have multiple big winners, more people buy tickets. So people weren't buying as many tickets because there actually weren't enough big winners. But at the same time, the lottery launched these digital online games that are really fast and they're lower stakes, and people were winning more on there. So they were spending more money on giving prizes to these online winners, and then actually in the store on these high stakes games, they weren't getting money. So that ended up in this weird situation where the schools just got a smaller percent. And I guess the winners were taking the money from the schools.
So they're blaming us for not playing the right games, essentially, is what's happening.
Exactly.
Here, huh?
You need to go try to change your life with the Powerball. You don't need to be doing a little scratch-off online.
What about the money they spend on these commercials? The lottery commercials are the best darn commercials on television. They're Hollywood productions. They must cost a fortune.
So this initial audit, it showed that the money that they were spending on things like advertising and salaries were pretty stable. But I think what's going to happen now is there's going to be a deeper dive into the lottery, which they haven't done in a while. And that's going to look at what are the actual issues here? Are we, is this budget as effective as it can be? How can we make sure more money is going to schools? And how can we make sure this lottery is actually doing what it was intended to do when we passed it in 2005?
Well, stay tuned. We'll see if they can fix any of this. Prior to joining Republicans in overriding the governor's veto of an immigration enforcement bill, as we've alluded to earlier in the program, Charlotte Democrat Carla Cunningham made a long statement on the floor of the House explaining why she was joining her Republican colleagues, in which she made a comment that even then raised some eyebrows.
First, as a people, we need to recognize that it's not just the numbers that matter, but also where the immigrants come from and the culture they bring with them to another country. As a social scientist report, all cultures are not equal.
Now, she later told WFAE News that she should have said that all cultures are, quote, not the same. And she added this.
I want to make it clear, I am not a bigot and I am not anti-immigrant and I never have been. And I understand as an African-American woman what it's like to be discriminated against, because I have been.
But that wasn't enough for her to get the endorsement of Governor Josh Stein in the upcoming primary.
You heard the same speech I did on the floor, where she said that some people are better than other people, and that is not something I can endorse.
So, Steve, who did he endorse?
He is throwing his weight, behind community activist Rodney Sadler, who appears to be, you know, the emerging as the strongest candidate to oppose Carla Cunningham. Sadler has raised, says he's raised about $100,000. I it's just interesting that I think Carla Cunningham, the override vote to join with Republicans, I think was something that she would have survived. She has voted with them before in the past, but it's just so interesting. Once there's a video of you saying something or an audio, you know, it gets repeated on TV, gets repeated on the station. And that, you know, that's going to make this a very difficult primary. She's always won in the past, but this news story rises to a new level. Yeah. And, you know, it's going to be a big challenge for her to keep her
Rodney
seat.
Rodney Sadler is a local activist. He's the director of the Center for Social Justice and Reconciliation at Union Presbyterian Seminary. What else can you tell us about him?
He was involved, I know, in the Moral Monday protests, back a decade ago when Republicans first took control in Raleigh. So he's someone who's been around for a long time. And, and again, I think without the video and audio of that speech, I don't think this is a particularly super competitive primary. I don't think the governor gets involved, but this is the second, I believe, the second race in the Democratic primary where he's backed, where he's given an endorsement.
Some people might say that she has given the Democrats a gift here, a reason to put up a candidate that might beat her, because she has crossed the aisle on several occasions. And we should remind folks that the Republicans no longer have a supermajority in the House. But when a Democrat crosses the aisle, then they can veto some legislation that the governor has already vetoed. They can override a veto by the governor. And in making his endorsement, Governor Stein said, quote, "The people of North Carolina deserve a representative who will fight for Democratic, big D, Democratic values." Is Sadler likely to vote with the Democratic bloc on most of these issues?
Yeah, that's what I spoke to him late last year. And he said, yeah, that's going to be a huge part of his campaign. I will vote to uphold Josh Stein's vetoes. And for the governor, there's really no downside in this endorsement. It's a very heavily Democratic seat. I mean, I don't believe there's even a Republican challenger. So you're either going to swap out a moderate conservative Democrat in Cunningham for someone more progressive, but it'll still be a Democratic seat regardless.
And Carla Cunningham responded to Stein's announcement saying this, quote, "While I respect the office Stein holds, the principle of separation of powers exists for a reason, to ensure balance and keep government accountable to the people, not personal agendas." What's she really saying there?
She's saying that the legislature plays a role and that she's entitled to her own vote, and that sometimes she will, almost all the time, Cunningham votes with Democrats, but there are going to be times that she votes with the Republicans when she thinks it's in the best interest of her community. And, you know, she's essentially saying, I'm not going to be a rubber stamp.
So the fallout continues at one of the city's largest breweries, Sycamore Brewing, following the company's owner or co-owner being charged with statutory rape. Of course, Sycamore is a popular South End brewery whose products are also sold in retail stores around the area, I think in seven states. Some area satellite locations, like the airport, have already shuttered, and some stores have pulled their products from the shelves. What is the latest shoe to drop, Ben, in this saga?
Yeah, the hits just keep on coming. Earlier this week, we found out that the Cotswold project that had been touted for months now, that has been scrapped. And then just in the last 24 hours, we obtained documents that show Sycamore Brewing is seeking a new name, and that is Club West Brewing. Now, earlier this week, on Monday was the last day that Sycamore, previously known Sycamore Brewery, was open in Southend. The sign has been taken down outside. What's not clear is when do they plan to reopen, and how exactly. Sarah Taylor, the now sole owner, has alluded to it, sort of a reimagining of the space. Not a completely clear yet what that's going to be and when it will reopen.
Yeah, she immediately announced after her husband was arrested on these charges that she was taking over Sycamore Brewing in total, and he was no longer a part of it. Now they've applied for a new name, Club West Brewing. At least that's the name of the limited liability company that runs and operates Sycamore. Are they planning to rename the actual stores and the bottles of beer as Club West Beverages? And will that help?
It's not clear yet if that's what they're going to do. And certainly the second question, I am not qualified to answer. Will it help? At this point, it's going to be a tough road to hoe for Sycamore, now Club West.
Well, WCNC-TV spoke to, because this is a big place in South End on Hawkins Street.
Yeah, you could not get any bigger.
Right. You guys went out and talked to some of the South End residents near that location about their reactions to the closure of the brewery's main location. Some expressed concern for employees because clearly they're being hurt by these shutdowns. Others felt that they should have shut down the location immediately when the news broke. And here's what one person named Drew had to say.
I think it should have happened much sooner. They probably should have just shut it down within the first 2 weeks and just kind of let it ride from there. I don't think there's much to revive it. I think you're going to have to kind of just hope that someone takes over the space, or you just offer dollar beers all summer. I mean, I think if you offer dollar beers all summer long, you send all the proceeds to the victim's family, people will embrace that and come back in.
Perhaps Drew is or should be in marketing or crisis management. Could he be right about this, or have we seen the last of Sycamore?
You know, you can criticize Sycamore, and I'll leave it to others to decide the fate of it. But you can't say Sarah Taylor did not respond quickly. I mean, the day the allegations came out, within about an hour and a half, she was out with a statement distancing herself from her now soon-to-be ex-husband and sort of charting her own path forward with the new business. It might not work, but you can't say that they weren't deliberative and quick to respond.
Of course, Justin Brigham is—that's the name of the man who is her husband, who has charged with statutory rape and other things—is innocent until proven guilty, and his next court appearance is scheduled for January 26th. So the saga will continue. I'm almost afraid of bringing this up for fear we might jinx things, but perhaps you've heard. The Panthers are in the playoffs. And now, like most of the season, their chances looked really good this year until they didn't. But thanks to misfortunes of other teams, they backed their way into this. They also won the NFC South division title for the first time since 2015. What kind of shot do they have against the LA Rams this weekend? Ben, Steve, who?
The Rams just a few weeks ago. They will certainly not be favored despite being a home team, but they did beat the Rams just a few weeks ago. They've won all the games that they're not supposed to win this year, lost all the games that they are supposed to win. So here's to them.
Yeah, they beat the Rams 31-28, and quarterback Bryce Young threw for 206 yards and 3 touchdowns in that game. And now they are the wild card team. Young is super, super excited.
Great opportunity. super excited. And then now it's about, you know, making something out of it. You know, we have to make sure, you know, today was a good start, but we have to make sure that we're dialed into the process. We have elite focus throughout the week to give us ourselves the best chance this weekend.
This is the Panthers' first appearance in the playoffs since 2018. They were a wild card team then, too. They lost in New Orleans. Cam Newton was the quarterback. It's rumored that he will be at Bank of America Stadium. This, in fact, is more than a rumor because they put Cam's voice in a video that they posted on X this
week. I'm back, but in essence, we back.
So Cam is supposed to be there banging the drum this weekend. The game is Saturday afternoon, by the way. Steve Harrison, Ben Thompson, Alexandria Sands, Ryan Pitkin, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.